Chapter 7. A Quiet Conflict. It seemed to Fiona that in the late summer of 2012, everyone was suffering from marriage breakups in Great Britain. Loving promises were broken. Partners who had once been trusted now hid behind their lawyers, not caring about the costs. Documents were changed, shared objects were fought over, trust was replaced by arrangement, and love revealed itself as a delusion. And the confused children? They were stuck between warring mothers and fathers, pushed between their separate houses, toys, coats, and pencils sometimes forgotten or left behind, with these facts occasionally reported to the lawyers. One parent was often accused of abuse. Usually they were accused by mothers, sometimes by fathers. Sometimes the children spent half the time with one parent and half with the other. Sometimes they could only see their fathers once or twice a month, or maybe never, as some men just disappeared into new marriages to make new children. And the money? Greedy husbands challenged greedy wives, taking what they could from the end of the war before both armies went their own ways. Men sent their money to foreign bank accounts. Women wanted an easy life in which they would never have to work again. Mothers stopping their children from seeing their fathers, fathers not supporting their children. Husbands hitting wives, wives lying and angry, drinking or taking drugs. The work of the family division went on. And there Fiona was, in conflict herself. Sometimes she thought she would like to send them all to prison, these people who put their needs above the interests of their children. The ones who wanted a younger wife, a richer or less boring husband, a different house, fresh sex, fresh love, a new world, a nice new start before it was too late. It was all about chasing pleasure. Of course, she was not serious when she thought this, and she knew that her anger was because she had no children herself, and because of Jack. As part of these secret thoughts, he would have been sent to prison for spoiling their marriage in order to try something new. And why not? For life at home in Gray's Inn since his return was difficult. There had been arguments, and she had shown some angry feelings. He said sorry again and again, but also complained in his defence that she was distant from him, that she was cold. He even said one night that she was no fun and did not know how to play anymore. This made her more angry than anything, since she knew that it might be true. At least he was no longer saying that he loved her. Their most recent argument, 10 days ago, repeated all the accusations they had made before, and they then stopped, tired of each other and themselves. Since then, nothing. They went about their days, their separate working lives in different parts of the city, and when in the apartment, moved softly and quietly around each other. They did not have meals together. They worked in separate rooms and refused any invitations to dinner or parties. She had given him a new key, that was all. She understood from the things that he had said that he had not found ecstasy in the statistician's bed, but that didn't make her feel better. Might he look for it somewhere else? Maybe he was already looking for it. She remembered her promise to leave him if he slept with Melanie, but she did not have the time or energy to organise the breakup of her marriage. And she was still unsure. She did not trust her mood at the moment. If he had given her more time after he left, she would have reached a clear decision and worked to end the marriage or try to save it. So she threw herself into her work in the usual way and tried to survive one day at a time. When one of his nieces left her children with them for the weekend, twin girls aged 8, things were easier because they could concentrate on something outside of themselves. She would read them stories, and as she was speaking, a wave of love for them rose in her throat. She was feeling old and foolish. It troubled her to be reminded how good Jack was with children as she watched him play games with them in the garden and act out the stories he read them with different loud voices. But on Sunday evening, after the twins had left, the rooms became small again and the air full of quiet conflict. Then Jack went out without explanation. To meet someone, she wondered, as she tidied up the spare room, putting toys back in the cupboard, with that feeling of sadness and emptiness that can come when children suddenly leave. That feeling stayed with her into Monday morning, and only began to fade when she sat at her desk to prepare for her first case of the week. At some point, Nigel Pauling must have brought in the post, for the pile was suddenly there at her elbow. She noticed a small blue envelope resting on the top. She nearly called back her clerk to open it for her as she saw the strange large handwriting and the stamp not quite in the right place. She expected it to be more badly written abuse from someone she'd ruled against. But then she saw the postmark and, suddenly suspecting who it was from, opened it quickly and saw that she was right. She had been expecting it for weeks. She had spoken to Marina Green and knew that Adam was doing well, catching up on schoolwork at home, and was expected to return to his classroom soon. "My lady, this is my seventh, and I think it's going to be the one that I post." The first few words of the next paragraph had been drawn through with a line of pen. "It will be the simplest and the shortest. I only want to describe to you one event. I realise now how important it is. It's changed everything. I'm glad I waited, because I wouldn't want you to see the other letters I wrote. Too embarrassing. But not as terrible as the names I called you when the nurse told me your decision. I was sure you'd seen things my way. In fact, I know exactly what you told me, that it was obvious that I knew my own mind, and I remember thanking you. I was still shouting when that awful Dr. Rodney Carter came in with the others. They thought that they were going to have to hold me down, but I was too weak for that. Although I was so angry, I knew what you wanted me to do, so I held out my arm and they started. The thought of someone's blood going into me was so horrible that I was sick across the bed. But that isn't what I wanted to tell you. It's this. My mum couldn't bear to watch, so she was sitting outside my room, and I could hear her crying, and I felt really sad. I was sick again, and then I fainted. When I woke up, my parents were both there by my bed, and they were crying. Then I felt even sadder because we had all disobeyed God. But this is the important thing. It took me a while to realise that they were both crying for joy. They were so happy, hugging me and each other and thanking God and crying at the same time. I felt too strange, and I didn't work it out for a few days. I didn't think about it, but then it came to me. That thing people say, have your cake and eat it. I never understood that saying before, but now I do. Your cake is still in your hand even though you've eaten it. My parents obeyed the elders and did everything that was right, and at the same time, they can still have me alive. Transfused, but we didn't choose it. Blame the judge, blame the godless law, blame the world. Thank God. We still have our son, even though we said he must die. Our son, the cake. I don't know what to think about this. Has it all been a lie? It was a turning point for me. When they brought me home, I moved the Bible out of my room and put it in the hall face down on a chair, and I told my parents that I did not believe in the faith anymore, and they can throw me out of the community if they like. We've had some terrible arguments. Mr. Crosby has visited, but I won't listen to him. I've been writing to you because I really need to hear your calm voice and have your clear mind discuss this with me. I feel you've brought me close to something else, something really beautiful and deep, but I don't know what it is. You never told me what you believed in, but I loved it when you came and sat with me and we did the Sally Gardens. I still look at that poem every day. I love being young and foolish, and if it wasn't for you, I'd be neither. I'd be dead. I wrote you lots of stupid letters, and I think about you all the time and really want to see you and talk again. I daydream about us, impossible, wonderful dreams, like we go on a journey together round the world in a ship and we walk up and down on it talking all day. My lady, will you please write to me just a few words to say that you've read this letter and you don't hate me for writing it? Yours, Adam Henry. P.S. I forgot to say that I'm getting stronger all the time. She didn't post the note that took her almost an hour that evening to write. In her fourth and final draft, she thought that she sounded friendly enough. She was glad to learn that he was home and feeling better, pleased that he had good memories of her visit. She told him to be loving towards his parents and that it was normal to question things when you were a teenager. She finished by saying, although it was not true, that she had smiled at the idea of a boat trip around the world. She wrote that when she'd been young, she'd had dreams of escape just like his own. That wasn't true either, because she'd been too hungry, even at 16, to do well at school to think about running away. Teenage visits to her cousins in Newcastle had been her only adventures. But when she looked at her short letter a day later, she did not find it friendly, but cold and distant. She read his again and loved its earnest, warm words. No, better to send nothing than to make him feel bad. If she changed her mind, she could write later.